2 Corinthians chapter 10. The 13th talk in a series on the book of 2 Corinthians was presented by Ron Julian on September 7, 2014 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Today we're launching into one of the most unusual sections in any of the Apostle Paul's letters, I think. I have always found it to be very unusual. This is the last four chapters of 2 Corinthians. I call it Paul Goes to War. In this section, Paul takes on his enemies in Corinth. These four sections are filled with sarcasm. In these chapters, Paul makes the sharpest criticisms of his enemies that I am aware of anywhere. And in these chapters, Paul makes the strongest defense of his own apostleship. The tone of these chapters is so confrontive that many scholars have argued that this doesn't belong in this letter. Think about what we just had. We just had basically an appeal for money. We're doing the Jerusalem collection. We talked about that, and Paul is encouraging them to follow through on what they had promised. And so the argument is, you don't follow up an appeal for money by insulting the people that you're writing to. So it's argued, well, this section must be from another letter that he wrote. Maybe it's from the sorrowful letter that he talked about, somehow got grafted onto this letter, or from another letter that he wrote. Well, I'm not convinced by that perspective. I think that 2 Corinthians is one unified whole. This rather harsh conclusion to the letter does belong to the rest of the letter. If we think about what we've been seeing, 2 Corinthians shows evidence of a great strain between Paul and the church at Corinth. He does say some explicitly encouraging things to them, but mostly he explicitly and implicitly addresses a number of problems between himself and the Corinthians. So let me give you just a quick reminder of what has led up to this. Paul basically defending himself from beginning to end in this letter. He defends himself by saying he has conducted himself with godly sincerity, presumably because some would deny it. He defends himself against the charge of being unconcerned and hypocritical toward the Corinthians. This was because he didn't come and visit them as he had said he would. And his defense is that the last time he visited, things got so bad that he had to leave and write them a very stern and sorrowful letter. So he's defending himself by saying, I couldn't come. It would have been bad if I had come. It was better for me to write the letter. Paul defends his ministry by saying that he is not like many peddling the word of God, but that he speaks from sincerity. He defends his ministry by reminding them that he really should not have to defend it, that the power of his ministry of the new covenant should be clear to them. They can look amongst themselves and see the results of his ministry. He defends his ministry by saying that his gospel ministry is more important than Moses, because the gospel is all about the Spirit of God transforming us. Paul defends his ministry by saying that even though Paul as a man is inadequate to have such a powerful impact, God has made Paul adequate as an apostle of Christ. Paul defends his ministry by saying that God sees Paul's faithfulness very clearly, but Paul wishes that the Corinthians could see him clearly as well. As for the Corinthians, Paul urges them not to receive the grace of God in vain. He chastises them. His heart is open to them, he says, but the Corinthians are withholding their affection from Paul. And he ends with a final emotional appeal. Make room for us in your hearts. We wronged no one. We corrupted no one. We took advantage of no one. This is not the sort of thing that you say to someone with whom you're having a really great relationship. He does speak to them about the collection of money for Jerusalem, but his pastoral concern is that they follow through with what they had promised to do, which they had not been doing. He implies that covetousness may be motivating them to keep the money. And he goes to great lengths to demonstrate that he, Paul, is handling this money with integrity. The other churches have sent men to go with him. He's really concerned that everyone look at him and recognize that he is acting honorably in how he is handling this money. So even Paul's fundraising hints at the Corinthians' possible greed and mistrust of Paul. So no, as we come into this last section, I don't think the last chapters here are out of place. This whole letter is Paul appealing to the Corinthians to not listen to those who mistrust and dismiss him. And also, I think one of the things that characterizes this section that makes it sound different somewhat in its intensity to what came before it is that you'll see as we go along that Paul has turned his attention to that subset of people in Corinth who are actively against him. That's who he's talking to in this section. I mean, he's talking to the whole church, but he keeps addressing the issues that his opponents are raising. Notice right away in chapter 10, verse 2, I ask that when I am present, I may not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against some who regard us as if we walked according to the flesh. And all I want to point out there is, it is some of them who regard Paul as if he walked according to the flesh. And that some is going to be running throughout this. He's going to talk about some who say this, or those who are against him in a certain way, or so on. And so he's speaking to the whole group about issues that are being raised by a very active minority of the group that are against Paul. So we're going to see that throughout. There's also evidence, as we'll see, that some of Paul's opponents have come from outside Corinth and are setting themselves up as teachers and opposing Paul. He talks in one place about false apostles. So I think this shows us why this section has the feel that it does. Paul has been writing to a varied group. Some are more on his side than others, but he is turning his attention, facing head-on the criticisms that are coming from his opposition. So that's what characterizes the tone of this. And the tone just gets harsher and harsher as we go along, chapter by chapter. So some of those that he is writing to are actively and explicitly his enemies, but many others in the church are probably confused by the situation. They're hearing Paul on one hand, but they're hearing from these other people on the other hand, and it has created a very tumultuous situation. So in these last chapters, the gloves come off for Paul. To his opponents, Paul has strong words of warning and criticism. To the church at large, Paul is warning them not to listen to these opponents of Paul and the gospel. We've seen throughout this letter that Paul has been defending himself and his ministry, but now he writes the strongest, most blunt defense of himself that you will find anywhere. Most of these four chapters is Paul talking about himself and in response to the criticisms that have been made against him personally. Okay, so starting then in verse 1 of chapter 10. Now I, Paul, myself, urge you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, I who am meek when face to face with you, but bold toward you when absent, I ask that when I am present, I may not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against some who regard us as if we walked according to the flesh. Okay. I want to explain a few things here, and then we'll look at the whole thing. There are a few pieces that are a little not immediately apparent what they're talking about. Let's start with the strange way that Paul describes himself in this section. I, who am meek when face to face with you, but bold toward you when absent. Okay, so is this Paul's self-conception? Is this the way he thinks about the way he conducts himself? Does he approve of this? Is he saying this is a good thing that he's that way? It sounds a little bit hypocritical. When Paul's at a safe distance, he writes a bold letter, but when he's face to face, he backs down and gets meek. Well, I'm convinced that this is not Paul's self-conception, that he is being sarcastic, and he's being very sarcastic at this spot. This is not how Paul sees himself. This is how his opponents in Corinth see him. And we'll see a few verses later, specifically, he's going to quote the sort of thing that they say about him, which is exactly like this. Yeah, he writes a big letter, but in person, he's nothing. So he's basically being accused by his opponents of being a paper tiger. When he's writing letters, he talks big, but when he is there among them, he is meek, and as we're going to see, unimpressive, they say. So we'll see a little bit more of that as we go along. But so I understand Paul to be sarcastically echoing their language here. Yeah, right. I'm the guy who is meek in person but bold in my letters when I'm at a safe distance. Now, part of my argument for why this is sarcasm is that, as we are going to see as we go through these chapters, there is a lot of sarcasm in these. So if this is sarcastic, it's in good company because there is a lot of sarcasm in this section. We won't see a lot of it today. We'll see it more as we go on to the later chapters. Okay, now, they say he's meek in person. Why would they say that about him? How does Paul conduct himself when he's there? We don't have a lot of evidence to go on to sort this out. In the two Corinthian letters, we see that it seems that Paul has visited Corinth twice. The first time is when he founded the church, and he was there for a year and a half. In 1 Corinthians, Paul describes what he was like when he visited that first time. He says, "And when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified, and I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling." Okay, weakness and fear and much trembling. That doesn't sound like Paul was cutting a very impressive figure. And he himself says that it was not his intention to speak with superiority of speech or wisdom. As we're going to see, that's a big issue for Paul's opponents. So even his own testimony of how he was acting when he was with them sounds like he was not the most impressive and imposing figure when he was there. The second time he visited is what we've been talking about as the painful visit. There was a man who seems to have attacked or openly defied Paul, and Paul left and dealt with the situation by letter. We don't know a lot about it, but we do know that he didn't deal with it when he was there. He dealt with it by letter. Now, I'm sure from Paul's perspective that he was doing what made sense. A letter was probably the best way to deal with the lack of support he was getting from the Corinthians in this volatile situation. And events seem to have borne him out. They responded well to the letter, so it seems to have been a good way to approach it. Rather than attacking it head on when he was there, he went away, wrote them an impassioned letter of appeal, and they responded to it. Okay. But you can see how his opponents could use that against him. Yeah, Paul, he didn't have the guts to stand up and assert his authority when he was here. He had to go home where he was safe and then talk real big in a letter. So it's quite possible that would contribute to this criticism that's being made of Paul. He's meek when present and bold when absent. And Paul sarcastically repeats their criticism, "Yeah, right, that's me. That's me. Speaking of meekness, Paul starts out by saying that he wants to urge them by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. What is the meekness and gentleness of Christ? Jesus described himself as meek and lowly in heart. And yet, Jesus is the man who claimed to be the Messiah, the Son of God, the King of all creation. He walked into the temple compound and threw over the tables of the money changers. In a lot of ways, it's hard to understand what he means that he was meek and lowly in heart. But I think actually if we examine Jesus and the way he did things and what he advocated, we can see that in fact this was true. It is true that Jesus had a great authority. He claimed that authority. He didn't deny it. But he used that authority in the service of others. He didn't throw his weight around, even though he was the Son of God. He did not put his own needs and his own importance above that of other people. I think Jesus himself says it best in Matthew 20:25. Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not so among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." So I think this is the kind of model that Paul is trying to follow, the meekness of Christ, that Christ was not asserting himself, not seeking his own, but was sacrificing himself in service of others. Paul doesn't want to lord it over the Corinthians, even though he is, in fact, an apostle. In fact, this is the language he used in chapter 1, verse 24. He said, "Not that we lord it over your faith, but we are workers with you for your joy." That's what Paul wants to do. That's how he wants to conduct himself. He sees himself as a servant. He doesn't want to throw his weight around. He's not trying to make them treat him like a big deal. Yes, as an apostle of Christ, he is about to make an urgent appeal to them, but he is doing so on the basis of a gracious and gentle servanthood. He's saying, that's the way I want to pursue this. But notice, it is this language of the meekness of Christ that leads to Paul's sarcasm. Paul has tried to conduct himself as a meek and humble servant, but his opponents are throwing it back in his face. When Paul is here in person, he's a wimp. He's not the strong person that we want to see, that we would recognize as an authority that we would follow. So Paul is acknowledging that in the very pursuit of being Christ-like in the way he exercises his leadership, he's giving fuel to those who would charge him with being unimpressive in person. And so Paul talks about how he intends to act toward these opponents the next time he is with them. These opponents, he says of them that there are some who regard us as though we walked according to the flesh. And what I understand him to be saying here is that they evaluate Paul strictly on the basis of his natural personal attributes. As we see in the Corinthian letters, his opponents evaluate people based on how impressive they are. How powerful a speaker are they? What status in society do they have? What kind of big, impressive effect are they having in the world? We're going to see some of that in a few verses here, that one of the charges against Paul is that he's not a very good speaker. So this is how they evaluate Paul. They look at him by the natural, fleshly, worldly standards that make sense to them and say, this is not a guy that you would want to follow. The problem, of course, is that there is much more to Paul than his natural personal attributes. He is an apostle of Jesus Christ, supernaturally prepared by God to proclaim the truth of the gospel. So those opponents who evaluate Paul in fleshly, worldly terms have profoundly misunderstood him. Paul says that, in fact, it is his intention, the next time he is there, to be bold and courageous in dealing with these opponents of his. So let me read you verse 2 again. He says, "I ask that when I am present, I may not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against some who regard us as if we walked according to the flesh." Paul is speaking to the Corinthian church at large. He is saying, when I next come among you, I do not want to be bold toward all of you in the way I intend to be bold against some. There are those who do not recognize what God is doing through my ministry, who evaluate me by their own worldly standards. And when I come, I intend to deal with them boldly. So I don't want you all to join them in thinking this way. I don't want you all to be on the receiving end of what I'm going to give them. think that's what he's saying. It's kind of like what the Hulk, Bruce Banner, said, "You wouldn't like me when I'm angry." That's basically Paul saying, I'm planning to come and take names, and I don't want your names to be among them. Okay, so here's how I see what Paul is saying in these first two verses, kind of expanding it out. "Now I, Paul, have a powerful warning to give you, but I am seeking to emulate the meekness and gentleness of Christ, the way he sought to serve others and not just himself. I am not seeking to lord it over you or promote my own importance over yours. Oh yeah, I know how some of you think about the meekness thing. Yeah, I'm the guy who's meek and wimpy when I'm there in person, but when I'm safely at a distance, I talk real big. I know that is what my opponents say about me. But I want you to listen to what I'm saying. I know that there are some among you who see me as a guy who walks according to the flesh, just like anyone else. There is nothing impressive about me by fleshly standards, and so they dismiss me. But despite my reputation for being a wimp in person, when I get there next time, I am going to deal with these opponents of mine boldly. My urgent warning to you is not to join them. I don't want to deal with you the way I am going to have to deal with them." That's what I understand him to be saying. So he's sort of laying down the gauntlet. It's time to deal with stuff, so you guys need to pay attention to where you are in this. Now, Paul goes on to talk about what the real situation is, as opposed to this picture that his opponents are regarding him as if he walked according to the flesh. He said, well, let me tell you what's really true about me. In verse 3, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And we are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete." So he says, though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. So Paul is acknowledging that in many ways he is just like anyone else. He walks in the flesh like any other human being. He's a man. He has his strengths and weaknesses. On his own, he's no big deal. And this should all sound very familiar to us because Paul has been saying this over and over through the letter. He himself as a man is not adequate for the task of being an apostle, but God has made him adequate as a minister of the new covenant. It is God who has empowered Paul to pursue his ministry and preach the truth of the gospel, unsullied by error or evil. Paul describes himself as like an earthen vessel that is carrying a great treasure. So yes, in some ways, his opponents are right. Paul is a man of flesh, like anyone else, with all the weaknesses that flesh is heir to. But, he says, he does not war according to the flesh. And this is how Paul sees the situation with his opponents. He is going to war against them, and he is not relying merely on the resources of his flesh. If they just think about him in terms of how they see his personal personality and characteristics and so forth, they're going to underestimate him. So, no, the weapons that he has to battle with are divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. It is the power of God at work in Paul's ministry, and most importantly, I think, what Paul is getting at, it is Paul's supernaturally empowered understanding of the truth of the gospel. He's not Superman. He doesn't come in and knock his enemies to the ground, but he has a profoundly deep understanding of the truth of the gospel. So Paul pursues a metaphor of military conquest here. The picture is of a general and his army laying siege to a fortress. And I saw one commentator suggest, and it makes sense to me, that his image here is actually the imagery of how such a battle would happen. First, the general destroys the fortress, breaks into it, breaks it down. Its walls are destroyed so that the people are no longer protected. Next, he takes captives from those who were protected in the fortress. And finally, he deals out punishment to those who will not surrender. So that may very well be what's behind the language that he uses here. So he lays out his metaphor. First is the destruction of the fortress. Paul says that his weapons, quote, are divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses, destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. So what are these fortresses that he is going to destroy? It is speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. The word speculations, it can mean reckonings, thoughts, arguments. In this case, it's a kind of rationalizing, I think, that he's getting at. It is all that thinking that his opponents have done that has got them tangled up. It is this thinking where they have convinced themselves that they understand better than Paul does what's going on. Well, Paul is destroying every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. In many ways, Paul's opponents seem formidable. They have raised up lofty ideas. They have fine-sounding reasoning for their position. But in the end, their lofty thinking is opposing the knowledge of God, and Paul is going to bring this imposing structure down. So the fortress that Paul is attacking is the reasonings and high-sounding thinking of those who oppose his gospel. After he destroys the fortress, then he takes prisoners. In this case, he is taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Paul does not want anyone's thoughts taking refuge in the high-sounding arguments of his opponents. Paul insists, as the conquering general, that everyone's thoughts must submit in obedience to Christ. That is, they must think as Paul has laid out in his gospel, not as his opponents have been arguing. And finally comes the punishment of the ones who have been fighting against you. Paul says, "We are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete." Now that's a bit confusing, at least confused me at first. When your obedience is complete, then we will punish disobedience. As I think about it, I think he's saying this: when the majority of the church as a whole has firmly committed itself in obedience to the gospel of Christ, then I will mete out punishment to those who continue to oppose that gospel. So he's making this distinction between the majority of the church for which he has hope and that some that he's been talking about that are his opponents, that he really doubts that they're going to come around and he's going to have to deal with them. He hopes that the majority will come around in the end. They will acknowledge that Paul is right and embrace his gospel fully. Perhaps they are like those captured in battle who surrender fully to the conquering army. But there are others who still hold out, who refuse to surrender. And those who are still disobedient to the gospel, Paul will punish. Okay, so if we step out of the military metaphor, what is Paul saying? There are those in Corinth who think Paul is nothing but an unimpressive man. But Paul, in fact, has been supernaturally empowered with the truth of the gospel. When he comes to Corinth again, he is going to confront his opponents directly. He is going to oppose their ideas with the truth. He's going to insist that people bring their thinking in line with the gospel. And those who refuse will be dealt with. Perhaps removed from the church. He doesn't really specify what this punishment would be that he's talking about. He's using the language of war very deliberately, I think. He has tried to act with a gentle servant's heart. He tells them that he's urging them according to the meekness and gentleness of Christ, but he wants them to understand when he comes, he is going to confront his opponents, reject their ideas, and deal with them in some decisive way. Okay, he goes on in 7. You are looking at things as they are outwardly. If anyone is confident in himself that he is Christ's, let him consider this again within himself, that just as he is Christ's, so also are we. For even if I should boast somewhat further about our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up and not for destroying you, I shall not be put to shame. For I do not wish to seem as if I would terrify you by my letters, for they say his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech contemptible. Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when absent, such persons we are also in deed when present. Okay, so Paul wants the Corinthians to see him clearly as he truly is. He doesn't want them being taken in by his opponents' misrepresentations of himself. I think that he has his opponents in mind when he says, if anyone is confident in himself that he is of Christ, let him consider this again within himself, that just as he is of Christ, so also are we. This anyone who is confident in himself that he is of Christ. I don't think he's talking about the average church person who says, yes, I think I'm a believer. He's talking about someone who has this self-confidence that they are speaking for Christ, as opposed to Paul. In this context, to be of Christ seems to mean more than just being a Christian. To be of Christ is to have a life and ministry that truly reflects Christ. Paul is saying, some of you may be very confident that you are speaking for Christ. Well, if you think that Christ would claim you, let me tell you that he certainly will claim me. I think Paul is speaking about his authority to speak for Christ. Whatever his opponents may think that their relationship is to Christ, let them make no mistake. Paul is speaking for Christ. And I think that becomes clear in the next verse because he's immediately going to talk about his authority. He's not just talking about whether he's a Christian. He's talking about whether he is of Christ, that is, whether his ministry is reflecting Christ, is coming from Christ or not. So he says, for even if I should boast somewhat further about our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up and not for destroying you, I shall not be put to shame. So if he should boast about his authority, he shall not be put to shame. I make the comment that, as a matter of fact, that is exactly what he's about to do. His if I should do this, is about to be fulfilled. He is going to boast about his authority. Not immediately, but in these four chapters, that's what this is about. The word boast is going to come up several times because this is the place where Paul just lays it on the line. This is who I am. This is my authority. This is what I have gone through. This is how you ought to think about me. And if you don't do something about it, I'm coming to kick rear ends. So certainly, Paul's saying that I could say a lot more about my authority, and it would all be true. I would not be put to shame later by being exposed as a liar. Now, Paul's not heavy-handed in his authority. He was given that authority, as he says, to build up the Corinthians, not to tear them down. He is their servant, working to build up their faith, but his authority is nonetheless real. And he's saying, if I were to go on and boast about it, I would not be lying. There is nobody that could put me to shame because what I would say about the authority that I have is true. And now Paul speaks specifically to the charge that he is different in person than he is in his letters. He says, for I do not wish to seem as if I would terrify you by my letters. For they say his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech contemptible. So here we see the evidence that Paul was speaking sarcastically above when he said, I am meek in person but bold in my letters. That's exactly the kind of incongruity that his opponents are charging him with. He quotes them directly and he uses sarcasm again, I think. I do not wish to seem as if I would terrify you by my letters. You know, he's saying, look, I have this reputation. I'm a wimp when I show up in person, but in my letters, I talk real big. Well, don't let me scare you or anything. I don't want to, you know, overstate anything in my letters here. Again, just that sort of mocking this criticism that has been thrown at him. I've always found this particular statement to be very helpful in understanding the Corinthian letters. Paul is explicitly quoting the criticism of his opponents, and you don't see that very often, where Paul actually says, this is what they are saying. But here he tells us directly, this is what they are saying. In person, he is unimpressive, and in speech, he is contemptible. Paul's opponents view the way he speaks with contempt, and I have always found that very helpful in understanding the first chapters of 1 Corinthians, where Paul goes on and on in defense of the way he speaks. Paul's Corinthian opponents, as I understand it, had a very Greek admiration for impressive, powerful debaters like the sophists. They wanted to be able to bring their friends to hear Paul and have them say, "Wow, that guy is impressive. I've never seen a speaker so powerful. I've never seen a speaker so dominate and destroy his opposition. Wow, we got to come hear this guy again. He is hot." Paul's friend Apollos was a powerful speaker like that, which is why some of the Corinthians preferred him to Paul. Paul says in 1 Corinthians and in 2 Corinthians both that he relies on the content of his speech, not on rhetorical manipulation. So Paul's opponents think that by worldly standards, he is not impressive in person. And so they say that there is a big difference between Paul in his letters and Paul in person. The implication, of course, is that Paul is hyping himself in his letters. It's easy to talk big when you are at a safe distance and writing, but when they see Paul in person, they realize that his letters are just full of hot air. I mean, that's the nature of the criticism that's being made against him. So he denies this explicitly. He says, "Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when absent, such persons we are also in deed when present." He insists that his letters and his actions in person are consistent. And reading the Corinthian letters, I think that we can see what he means. His letters and his actions are all motivated by his desire to humbly serve the Corinthians by building them up in the faith. Yes, he is an apostle of Christ with all the authority that that implies, with all the wisdom and profound understanding of the gospel that that implies, but it has never been his concern to throw his weight around. Because of his quiet meekness, he looks unimpressive in person by worldly standards. But if you look at his letters and his actions from the perspective that he is a designated servant of Christ serving the Corinthians in developing their faith, then you see that his letters and his actions are totally consistent. The way he conducts himself towards him is the way a person who wrote the kind of letters that he wrote would conduct himself when he was there. But of course, in this section, he's giving them fair warning. If they really want to see an impressive Paul, if they want to see Paul acting large and in charge, then that's exactly what he is going to do when he visits them again. So if you want to see me being bold, just wait till I get there, because that's what I'm going to do. Okay, Paul goes on in verse 12, "For we are not bold to class or compare ourselves with some of those who commend themselves. But when they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they are without understanding. But we will not boast beyond our measure, but within the measure of the sphere which God apportioned to us as a measure, to reach even as far as you. For we are not overextending ourselves as if we did not reach to you, for we were the first to come even as far as you in the gospel of Christ. Not boasting beyond our measure, that is, in other men's labors, but with the hope that as your faith grows, we shall be within our sphere enlarged even more by you, so as to preach the gospel even to the regions beyond you, and not to boast in what has been accomplished in the sphere of another. But he who boasts, let him boast in the Lord, for not he who commends himself is approved, but whom the Lord commends." Okay, so as will become clear as we go along, some of Paul's opponents are rival teachers. They are saying that people should stop listening to Paul and listen to them instead. Corinth is not the only place where this happened. Most of the churches that Paul founded had people who came afterwards and saying, "Don't listen to Paul, listen to us." Paul refers to them here as some of those who commend themselves. But he describes them as measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves with themselves. That is, I think what he's saying is they are measuring themselves by each other. They are comparing themselves to each other and using the measure as, how do I stack up against this other guy? And of course, they evaluate people according to how they walk according to the flesh, which is what Paul had said earlier. That's how they evaluate him, by worldly standards. So they say, I'm a better speaker than this guy. You should listen to me. I have a larger following than this guy. I am a more attractive person than these guys. My understanding is that the Greek sophists were known for this sort of thing, which would have an impact on the way the Greeks would think about a thing like this. A sophist would attract followers by making clever, powerful speeches, proving that he was better than other teachers. That's how you make your reputation, by coming in and tearing down the big guy in town, showing, look, he doesn't know what he's talking about. You should listen to me. That's what Paul's opponents seem to have been doing. They are making their reputations by showing how superior they are to Paul. They're better speakers. They are more impressive. They know what they're talking about, and Paul doesn't, and so forth. So Paul is saying then, I'm not so bold as to do what they're doing. I don't measure myself by them using these worldly standards. I don't argue that I'm a better speaker or more successful or that sort of thing. Yes, I am going to boast in the authority that the Lord has given me, but I am not going to commend myself in the way my opponents commend themselves. As he says in verse 13, he will not boast beyond his measure. And so in verses 13 and following, here's what I understand Paul to be saying. Let me just kind of sum it up. God has appointed to Paul the task of being apostle to the Gentiles. That is his sphere, the New American Standard has it. It's the rule that he must follow. It is his assignment from God. This has been given to him to do. His assignment extends to the Gentile town of Corinth. He can legitimately boast that God has given him the assignment of authoritatively bringing the gospel to the Corinthians. He's not boasting in other men's labors. Someone else didn't found the church in Corinth, and then Paul comes along and takes credit for it. No, God gave him the task of founding the church in Corinth, and he has faithfully carried out that task. So Paul hopes that when things settle down in Corinth, when they finally get it together so that he can relax about them a little bit, he will be able to move on to the regions even further west. As he later writes to the Romans, he hopes to come to visit them in Rome so that he can move on to Spain and then found churches there where no one has yet gone and founded churches. So why does Paul insist several times that he does not want to boast in another's accomplishments? God did give him the assignment of founding the church in Corinth, not someone else. He is not claiming credit for another's work. When he moves further west, he does not want to boast in what has been accomplished through someone else's assignment, someone else's work. Why does he keep saying, I just want to boast in what I have done, and I don't want to take credit for what somebody else has done? I think that Paul's saying all these things because that is how he is picturing these teachers who oppose him. They're poachers. They have come in on his work. He has founded this church in Corinth. Paul has carried out his assignment from God. He has faithfully carried out that assignment. But they have come in and dismissed Paul and said, you guys need to be listening to us. And so they're taking credit as the teachers who are showing the Corinthians the light. So I think Paul's purpose in verses 12 through 18 here is to differentiate his sort of boasting, which he's going to do about his authority, with the boasting of that of his opponents. His opponents use worldly standards to measure themselves by other people. Listen to me because I'm more accomplished than that guy. His opponents are boasting beyond their measure. They talk as if they were the true teachers in Corinth. Well, Paul's not like them. He is not using worldly standards to compare himself to them. He has never claimed to be a better speaker or more good-looking or whatever. Paul boasts within the appropriate measure. God himself has appointed Paul to be apostle to the Gentiles, and Paul has faithfully fulfilled that ministry to the Corinthians. As long as he keeps his boasting within that area, which is the actual truth, his actual calling, the actual faithful fulfillment of that calling, then he is not commending himself. And that's why Paul can conclude in verse 17, "But he who boasts, let him boast in the Lord. For not he who commends himself is approved, but whom the Lord commends." Paul is implying here, he said, I could boast about my authority, and he's going to go on and boast about his authority, but I am not commending myself in the way that my opponents commend themselves. I have been given my authoritative position by God, and so he is the one who is commending me. My opponents can't claim that. They can only commend themselves. Okay, so let me sum up what we've seen in chapter 10. In chapter 10, Paul goes to war, starts his war against his opponents. Some of those opponents are outsiders who have come into Corinth to oppose Paul. They want the Corinthians to listen to them rather than Paul. And some of the Corinthians, unfortunately, are listening to them, it seems. Paul's opponents see Paul as something of a fraud. Sure, he can write a strong letter, but in person, he lacks the qualities that makes a person truly impressive. Particularly, he's a very poor speaker by their Greek standards. Needless to say, Paul's opponents see themselves as having those qualities much more than Paul does. And so Paul responds to this situation. Yes, he says, "I know that my opponents say that I am meek and unimpressive in person, but I would warn you not to join them, because next time I come, the gloves will be off. My weapons are the divine empowerment that God has given my ministry. I will fight their errors with truth. I will call people to change their thinking in line with that truth, and I will deal harshly with those who oppose that truth." Paul is quite willing to boast in what is truly significant about himself, his authority as an apostle of Jesus Christ. He has been challenged. His opponents are saying, "Don't listen to him." He's saying, "Well, I could tell you about the authority that I have from the Lord himself, and I will not be put to shame, because it's true." But he doesn't want to boast as his opponents do. He will not compare himself to them as to who is a better speaker, who's more successful, etc. He will not, as they have done, step into another man's work and take credit for it themselves. No, Paul will boast using the appropriate measure, the calling of God. God has given Paul the assignment of being an apostle sent to the Corinthians, and so Paul will boast in what God is doing through Paul. His boast will be true. Let me just make one last comment. That was a lot to talk about there. I'm struck by what we see of Paul's style of leadership here. This really emerged for me in a way that it had not before in what he's saying to them in this section. Paul is committed to being a humble servant, a teacher of the truth. He wants to emulate the meekness and gentleness of Christ. But he is so committed to being a humble servant that his opponents could mistake him for being an unimpressive man. They could charge him with being nobody of particular significance, because Paul doesn't act big. He doesn't make himself look good through manipulative rhetoric. He's patiently waiting for the Corinthians to grow up and realize what is important. He can do this not because he is weak, but because he is strong. He doesn't care about his reputation as a man. He only cares about the progress of the gospel he preaches, and that does involve defending his reputation as an apostle. He does want them to realize that the truth is being spoken by him. That's what God has given him to say. They need to pay attention to it. The only way to promote that gospel is by patiently and humbly teaching the truth. If Paul tried to impress people by the worldly standards using manipulative rhetoric and so on, he will be betraying the gospel, so he doesn't do it. He is patient and humble. So Paul is willing to endure the reputation of being something of a wimp by pursuing the meekness and gentleness of Christ in the way that he carries out his ministry. But on the other hand, Paul is not infinitely patient. He is willing to go to battle when enemies of the gospel are trying to mislead the Corinthians. And that's what is impressive about Paul to me. He has the strength to patiently teach the truth without concern for his reputation, and yet he has the strength to stand up and fight for the truth when it needs to be done. It just strikes me as I think about it, in the modern world, many Christian teachers have built empires based on their powerful speaking skills and attractive personalities. There's a lot of this going on right now in our world. We need to evaluate the people that we listen to using the standards that Paul has. We're not looking for persuasive rhetoric that can attract a huge following, but faithfulness to the gospel message. So I'm just struck that the model that we see of Paul here, I had never quite realized in thinking about Paul. You know, he has a reputation for being kind of a hard-nosed guy. I mean, you know, he was the guy who's holding the coats when they stoned Stephen, and he's going out to get all the Christians arrested and everything, and he says, oh no, we're not going to take John Mark with us to Barnabas because he blew it last time. And so we can think of Paul as being this kind of tough guy who goes in and alienates people by how aggressive and powerful he is, but that doesn't seem to be the case. In fact, the reputation he has among his opponents is that he's too weak to be any good, that he is he doesn't assert himself, he's not speaking with the sort of power that would commend him as an authoritative sort of person. And Paul has to say to them, don't mistake my pursuit of the meekness and gentleness of Christ with a lack of will to deal with error when I find it. So I just was really struck by that this time and find myself thinking that I would like to be a person like that, who would be strong enough not to care about my reputation in the pursuit of proclaiming the truth as I understand it, and yet strong enough to deal with problems when they arise. Like I said, that's what I would like to be true of me. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about chapter 10. It gets weirder as we go along, but we have an opportunity for any comments or questions you might have.
I guess I have the mic first. Okay. I think you are a person like that, Ron. And now I'll go on. Kind of a basic question. How did Paul know what his opponents were saying about him?
Well, we know of certain avenues of knowledge that he would have had. Of course, there was the year and a half that he was with them the first time when he founded the church. We know, we're pretty sure, in 1 Corinthians, there's this whole section, the second half of the letter is now concerning this topic, blah, 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 now concerning this topic, blah, blah, blah. And it seems to be the case that he had been written a letter that asked him questions about things. So, and those letters are coming with people who are delivering the letters who were there in the situation and kind of know what's going on. So I think that Paul is hearing reports. Now, in this particular situation, he has gone to visit them a second time, and he knows all the problems that were there and why he had to leave and why he had to write them the sorrowful letter. Now Titus has come back from visiting him and and although Paul reports to them how he's pleased that Titus was encouraged, that they responded positively to the letter, I'm sure Titus is also telling Paul, and we have these guys doing this and these guys doing this. So Paul knows the people there personally, and he's getting reports from the people that these letters are, that are carrying these letters back and forth. So I assume that that's how he knows what's going on.
Thanks, Ron. There's a lot I don't know about Paul's ministry, and one thing I don't know is how the Corinthians responded to this letter.
Yeah, we don't know that. We know how they responded to the sorrowful letter that preceded this one. Paul is in Macedonia writing this letter, and Titus takes it back, at least what he describes is going to happen here. Titus takes it back, arranges for the money to be brought together for the Jerusalem collection so that when Paul arrives, presumably with some people from Macedonia with him, it will be all ready to go. And we see from this section that Paul is saying, I am going to deal with the troublemakers when I get there. So, Yeah, we don't have, Acts doesn't tell us. It just tells us that he went to Corinth and he stayed there for several months. Yeah, it would be very interesting to know how they responded. I would hope. Paul is really hopeful that the core of the believers in Corinth are really going to get on board with what he's urging them to believe and pursue and to not listen to these other voices and so on. And of course, my hope would be that that's what they did, but we don't know.
Ron, would you tell me how he's using the word boast? Because when I see this, I think about bragging, like, you know, the Ducks are better than the Spartans or
right.
whatever, you know.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. So Paul uses the word boast in both positive and negative ways throughout his letters. So the English word boast doesn't quite capture the way to translate it, I think, because I really, as my understanding would be that the word was neutral and it was the issue was what was being boasted in that either marked it as something negative or positive. I have always understood the sense of the word boast to, I point to something about my circumstances or about myself with satisfaction. I look at that and say, see, that is something that pleases me. This is something that I am glad for you to look at because this is a good thing. So in Romans, Paul, the early part of Romans, he's criticizing the Jews for boasting in the law and boasting in God, but the criticism is that they are boasting, they are pointing with satisfaction to the fact that they are God's people, they're the one that God likes, whereas in fact their boast is an empty one. They don't understand that just their pursuit of the Jewish law, the way they have pursued it, does not at all mean that necessarily that they have this relationship with God that they're boasting in. But when he gets to chapter 5, then he says, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God, and we boast in hope of the glory of God, we boast in our tribulations, and then finally he says, and we boast in God, which earlier he had criticized the Jews for boasting in God. But we, as believers in Christ, boast in God because, as he said, it's through Christ who brought about the reconciliation. So my boast is not God thinks I'm hot stuff, I have done everything right. My boast is Christ died for my sins. I have a relationship with God that I don't deserve. So it's a boast, but it's not a boastful kind of boast. It is a humble sort of, I am so glad I can point with great satisfaction to the fact that I have been forgiven for my sins. So I think it's that sort of thing. So his boast that he's making here, it's not that the boast is a bad thing. It's this, let me tell you something true about me that I think is something worth knowing that I find great satisfaction is. That is, God has called me to be an apostle of Jesus Christ and empowered me to carry out that ministry. But the bad part of it is when he says, if you boast beyond your measure, if what his opponents are doing is boasting beyond their measure, they're coming in and saying, you ought to listen to us rather than Paul. And the question would be, why? Because you're a powerful speaker? Because people applaud when you're done? Because people go home saying, wow, that guy was impressive? Is that why they should listen to you rather than Paul? Paul can claim that he's an apostle sent by God with a profound and supernaturally empowered understanding of the gospel. Now, why should we listen to you again? What is it that you've got that makes it so that we should listen to you? So their boast is an empty one. Their boast is in this, how they walk in the flesh, how they're the worldly sort of accomplishments that they have. It's not that the boast itself is bad, because Paul is willing to boast, and he says, I won't be put to shame. When I point out the authority that I have that has been given me through the Lord and explain to you what that authority is all about, I will not be put to shame. So yeah, boast, what was that? The New American Standard in 5 doesn't translate it boast, it's and we exult, is it? Okay, yeah. And that would be one way of doing it, but it doesn't. That doesn't quite capture it either. It's somewhere between exult and boast. It is boast in the sense that I'm saying, look at this. Look at this. This is good. But it's not a, hey, look at this, I'm hot stuff. It's, look at this. It's true. This is good, isn't it? And it's true. So, yay for that. I'm an apostle. That's good. That's a good thing. You should listen to me. I'm just a guy. I'm not adequate in myself to do this stuff. I walk in the flesh like anyone else, but I'm an apostle who knows what he's talking about, and I will boast in that. That's why you should listen to me.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
Oh, Ron, when you were kind of making reference to, like, what's going on today is kind of parallels this, were many of the people that were coming against him honestly thought that they were Christians? It's just they were influenced by bad thought, or were they trying? Because the reason why I'm saying that is because today, see, I think in the early 80s, maybe late 70s, you had a lot of preachers attacking each other and, you know, the mess that kind of came from that.
Right. Yeah, notice how he said, if anyone is confident in himself that he is Christ's, let him consider this again within himself, that just as he is Christ, so also are we. And I see that as being directed against his opponents. So yeah, they would say, we are the voice of Christ that you ought to listen to. So they're not. Now, see, there's a lot of discussion and debate about what is it exactly. There does seem to be some who have come in and are opposing Paul. What are they about? What was their message? 2 Corinthians doesn't deal with that in the way that something like Galatians does. Galatians makes it clear this group, the Judaizers, came in, and Galatians talks about the message that they had and why they shouldn't listen to that message. 2 Corinthians is talking about the fact that they have attacked Paul and said you shouldn't listen to him, and he's speaking to the issue of why you should listen to me. He's not saying much about what they said that you shouldn't listen to. It's just it has been set up against the knowledge of God, whatever it is. So some people argue that maybe it's Judaizers again. There, it could be. I mean, there were other, the Judaizers went to other places that Paul had taught and went in after him and said, okay, yes, you need to believe in Jesus. Jesus is the Messiah, but you need to be circumcised and live as a Jew and so on. So that's possible. There isn't really much hint of that, except it all depends on how you understand what's at stake in chapter 3, like when Paul's saying that his ministry is better than Moses. I mean, it's possible that back behind that is that some sort of argument that Judaism ultimately is what this is about, and Christianity is just, let's add Jesus as the Messiah to Judaism. So Moses, in essence, kind of is still the most important figure, the law of Moses and so on. So Paul could, because he does in that section say, you know, the law ends up bringing condemnation. So when we were in that section, I can't remember what I said at that spot. I was still wrestling with that question. I may have said that I didn't know whether there was something like that going on, or I might have even said, I don't think there is necessarily. Now that I'm looking at this section, which I had read before, obviously, but I'm kind of looking more carefully at it, I'm more inclined to think that there may be some more references to his opponents and what he said earlier. I mean, we have this language, we are not like some peddling the word of God, and it occurs to me maybe that's the same some that he's talking about here, that it's not just a general sort of statement about what happens in the world, but actually specifically about people that they're facing. And there are other places like that where he says things that I'm not like this as some are. And I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe we're getting a glimpse of what it is that they were about. So it is possible that it's something like the Judaizers or something along those lines. But like I say, Romans makes it really clear that Paul's dealing, from my perspective, largely with the Jewish opponents to the gospel. They wouldn't call themselves Christians. Galatians is dealing with the Jews who were Judaizers. They would call themselves Christians, but urged that you had to follow Judaism. Here, if we have any hints at all, they're just little hints as to what the issue might be. This is really more personal. I mean, Paul knows the Corinthians probably better than any of the other groups that he writes to. He was there for a year and a half. He's had this long relationship with them, a very tumultuous relationship with them. So I think he's trying to appeal to them personally in a way, come on, you guys, I have done everything for you. Why are you resisting me? Why are you listening to these voices that are saying that you shouldn't listen to Paul, that Paul doesn't care about you? Paul should have come when he said he was going to visit, and Paul doesn't know what he's talking about, and you should listen to us. Where is this coming from? Why are you guys listening to that? And that's kind of the tone of this letter, is more, why are you thinking about me that way? And he doesn't really speak to the theology so much of the opponents as the attack on Paul. So.
Well, Corinthians is really complicated because of its history and so on, and how many, gosh, I don't know how many religions there were floating around in Corinth at the time.
Oh, right, yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken from history, there were some very powerful pagan leaders, actually, in Corinth.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, yeah, a complicated city and a complicated relationship and a complicated set of letters. I mean, these are long, two very long letters that Paul writes, filled with little clues as to what was going on between Paul and the Corinthians. Okay, well, thank you. Like I say, I mean, you know, maybe you just roll with this stuff. From my perspective, it gets weirder as we go along. So we'll see.